It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We welcome the Washington Post's climate coach to field your questions on how to live more sustainably. A shout out to Louise in Milwaukee, who called in recently to suggest we discuss more solutions for climate change.
But specifically what we can do here in Wisconsin to address it.
Margot in Menominee and Val in Eau Claire both made similar requests in recent weeks. Val wrote, "What can I do in my everyday life to make a small difference in climate change?" Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Corin writes the climate coach advice column for The Washington Post, previously spent almost two decades as a journalist covering climate, technology, and economics. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Good morning. Your column looks at climate change from that personal perspective and how we can prevent it. What lifestyle changes have you made since you've been reporting on climate change?
That's a great question. Well, I've been thinking about this since grad school, so it's been about 20 years, so it hasn't just been the column. But, you know, since I had to start writing that and thinking about this on a daily basis, a few things that I've done. One is I just started tracking. So there's a way that you can actually hook up your credit cards to an app called Commons, and that gives you a very clear insight into what your emissions are based on what you're doing. And that's really illuminating, and it actually allows you first to get a handle on you know, what the impact is. And then I do things like compost, and, you know, I think about transportation a lot. So it's not, we have a car, but it's electric, and then we use bike and bus a lot. And, you know, most of all, you know, I think it's tricky because, you know, this is a systematic problem, and it's not that any one of us is going to be able to fix it. But the ability for, you know, anyone to demonstrate what's possible actually has a much larger effect because it affects people around you. And so I think about that even more than the individual action. So how can it affect people around you?
Can we go back to the credit card app for a moment here? So you're basically able to translate your purchases and show the impact on the planet. Can you give a little bit more?
Sure. So what you do is you hook up your credit cards to Commons and your bank account if you want, and it just looks at your transactions. So what are you buying? And each of those transactions has an estimated greenhouse gas emissions associated with it. And while it's not precise or at least perfect, it's pretty close. And so that at least gives you a ballpark understanding of what your emissions are. And then you have the choice of either reducing them or offsetting them, or even just being aware of it. And when I talked with the founders of it, they mentioned that even just the awareness actually has a huge impact. Hmm. So people who don't necessarily offset their emissions actually reduce them just because they know.
You take questions from people who are confused about how they should live to further prevent climate change. What are some of the most common questions you get?
Well, let's see. EVs are a big one. Like, you know, what is the most efficient way to get around? Mm-hmm. And I think people are quite interested in that. Food is another one. And get that quite a bit. I think people are really want to know about they're quite, you know, intuitive about where their emissions are coming from, which tends to be their home, their transportation, and their food. There are other questions, of course, but those are the three biggest.
And we're going to dissect those areas as we go on here. Something I wonder, though, there is that sentiment that individuals are not exactly to blame for the climate crisis, that we really need to look to corporations who should be liable for the decisions that they make. And, you know, because, you know, that is what will make the biggest difference. How do you feel about that line of reasoning?
It's a great question. It's not entirely wrong, of course. Companies are responsible in many ways for a lot of those emissions, as is policy. But if you look at the big picture and you look at how do we get to 2 degrees? So how do we keep temperatures from rising above 2 degrees? Behavioral change and individual action has to be part of that. So I don't see those as exclusive, and I don't think it's particularly productive to say, you know, it has to be this or that. Hmm. That is not to remove responsibility from any party, but it is just to say that to get where we need to go, we do need to be able to shift society at the individual level and as well as at the community level. Let me give you one good example. The emissions, the popularity of solar panels was studied, and they tried to figure out what is the most important factors in predicting whether someone would have solar panels on their roof. And obviously, this is a major piece of our emission reduction strategy. And the answer was not subsidies or geography or even wealth. It was primarily whether your neighbor had solar panels on their roof.
Wow.
And so it was even sort of a relationship between proximity. So the closer you are, the more likely you are to have them. So I think that is like the key here, is that we're not just talking about what do you do, but what do you do that then influences the system? And I try to focus on that in the column, is not just what do individual actions mean, but what do they mean in the larger system?
Talking with the Washington Post climate coach, Michael Corin is here as we get advice for how to live during this time of climate change. You can join in with your questions and comments for the climate coach, 800-642-1234. Michael, as you mentioned, rooftop solar, you've looked at how people can design homes to reduce their carbon footprint and deal with extreme weather. And you wrote how people are building roofs wrong. What is going on there?
Well, there's a better way in many cases if you're replacing your roof, or even if you just have a roof and you live in a very hot climate, which is called passive cooling. It's just one of the cheapest things you can do that or it doesn't even cost you anything if you're already redoing your roof, that reduces your heating and cooling bills, or your cooling bills specifically. So just the idea that if you live in a hot climate, or even in the north, for example, in New York during the summer, you might have rooftop temperatures of 190 degrees Fahrenheit. And the original way to reduce that before we had, you know, mechanized cooling was through painting your roof white. That reflects a lot of radiation back into the sky. And so we have materials like that, but now we also have materials that don't even have the color. You can get any color you want, but they're reflective of basically this electromagnetic radiation, the sunlight, that puts it back into space and cools the temperature. It's not a huge effect, at least, you know, maybe a few degrees, or in some cases, it can, in terms of the interior temperatures, but mm-hmm. It can have a huge effect for a city. So there are cities now that are mandating this because it's such a public health risk when during the summer the temperatures in cities rises so much higher than the surroundings.
And think of how much roofing is done across cities in putting on new roofs. That could change an entire industry.
That's right. There's almost no reason not to do it since it's now the same cost. A lot of these shingles are the same cost as conventional ones. And if you want to go the full way, you can actually reduce your air conditioning cost quite a bit in hot climate. So I predict, you know, places like Phoenix and California and Florida, this will become pretty much standard, if not mandated. And there are places, further north where it does make sense.
How difficult is it in researching and answering the questions you get?
Well, luckily, like I said, I've been doing this for a long time. So I have a fair amount of experience kind of diving into the science and speaking with engineers. But it's not easy. It's not always easy because there's a lot of it depends. And so what I try to do is, like the last article was on electric vehicles. And a lot of people ask, well, is it cheaper to fill it up? And, you know, it's just not a comparison between the gallon of gasoline and a kilowatt hour of electricity, because you have to look at when do you charge and where do you charge. So we did a hypothetical road trip across the country, two of them actually, and then ran the numbers. And I think that kind of research goes a long way to helping people make informed decisions.
So you're really trying to see apples to apples on some of these issues when it's just not a nice, neat, clear distinction.
That's right. Yeah. And a case like that is relatively difficult. Where others, it's relatively simple, which is if you have a gas furnace, replace it with a heat pump. You don't need to do a ton of research to know the exact numbers because it's going to pay off.
Michael Corin, known as the climate coach, climate advice columnist at the Washington Post, our guide as we explore ways to live more sustainably. And you can call in with your question, your concerns, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Washington Post's climate coach, Michael Corrin, is here and up to the challenge of answering tough environmental questions with tips on what actions we can take today to help the planet. Call in with your question, your comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Good morning. So my question for your guest is, has there been any type of research or studies done looking at the reflectivity off of lighter colored roofs to perhaps offset some of the loss of ice pack that we're seeing at the poles?
Marcus, thank you. Goes with what we were talking about, Michael.
Yes, that's right. Actually, there has been. And if when you look at it in aggregate, considering how many basically rooftop surfaces there are in the world, it actually would have a global effect if we were able to convert most of those to these types of surfaces. So that's just to give you an order of magnitude potential. Obviously, not all of those will be converted, but if you want to think about it at the city level, you will reduce the temperature of a city, you know, measurably if we convert it to those rooftop passive surfaces. So we're actually in Phoenix, they're doing that for asphalt. So thinking about that for roads, really anything that's being hit by the sunlight would have that effect. So yes.
Let's turn to food. The United Nations urging everyone to eat more plants and less meat in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And yet meat consumption keeps growing every year. How beneficial is adopting vegan or vegetarian diets?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's a very charged one. Well, I think you're absolutely right. People still eat meat, and I think they will continue to want to eat meat. So that is something that we can't just ignore. And I think people are going to make that choice. But it doesn't have to be vegan or even vegetarian to have a big impact. You know, there's this idea of the 80-20 rule where 80% of the impact comes from 20% of the effort. Hmm. And in this case, that's also quite true. So most of our emissions are coming from beef and dairy, beef specifically, and at least it's how it's raised today. And so when you want to think about how can I reduce the impact, it really does not need to be vegan or vegetarian. You're welcome to do that, but you really could think about it more as, you know, essentially beef and sheep and to some degree is where most of those emissions are coming from. So that would be one way to just start to kind of slowly make a difference, but you get most of your results from that early change.
Here in Wisconsin, our nickname, the Dairy State. So
I know.
You are in the midst of a big cheese state. Do Wisconsin residents have to give up cheese and brats completely? Do you have any tips on that?
Well, I don't think so. I actually, you know, even just a small reduction would have a huge impact. And I don't think that reduction would, and it would benefit a lot of people from a health perspective and other ways, which means maybe eating meat like twice a week instead of five. So I don't think that you'd have to give that up. And I wouldn't recommend that because I think we'd really, right at this point, only 5% of Americans identify as vegetarian and 2% as vegan. So it's not like that's going to become, I think, the majority. And a much better approach is to say, well, what makes sense for me personally? And then if you can look at that from an environmental perspective, you'll get most of the bang from your buck just from that early small reductions in meat consumption.
Talking with the Washington Post, climate coach Michael Corrin is here as we get advice for how to live during the time of climate change. You can join in with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. Chris is here in Port Wing. Chris, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for having this very important conversation. I wanted to suggest two things. One, your guest pointed out the idea of trying to keep global temperature average rise to 2 degrees. I'd like to suggest that a lot of scientists say it's important to try and keep it to 1.5. That was certainly the agreements made at Paris and other recent climate announcements. More than 1.5 leads to some pretty catastrophic effects, like 2 degrees would be pretty catastrophic, especially for the global south. The second thing I wanted to mention was that the narrative that individual actions are as important as mandates from government is a narrative that's been promoted by the fossil fuel companies. And in fact, if people want to try and have the biggest impact, they should talk to their representatives and get them to create mandated, mandatory policies to affect overall behaviors, like a carbon tax, like limits on the ability for companies to create large carbon effects. The largest 70 corporations in the world are responsible for about more than half of the carbon emissions. So we need to regulate and mandate these regulations at the state and federal government level. Thank you very much for your guest and your time.
Chris, thank you. That echoes what Tom and Wasaw called in to say, that it's important for people to reach out to all government representatives and not just talk to each other, so they know we're concerned about climate change and want something done about that. Michael, take it away on Chris's points.
Yeah, those are great points. I would love to see 1.5, and that is the agreement that we have, you know, that's been made at international conferences. We are fast pushing the time when 1.5 is going to be very difficult to reach, and even if we do everything today, it will be hard to get there. So I think we should try, and we should put everything we can behind it. The 2 degrees Celsius is going to be a very different planet and not one we are going to want to be on in the way that we hope. We need to every degree, every tenth of a degree matters. And so I just want to be clear that I think there's a tendency to be all or nothing on these targets, and it's a gradation. And I think it's as important to get as low as possible. And he also makes some great points. You know, I 100% think that political action is going to be critical to essentially keeping temperatures at a stable or habitable point for much of the world. I do not see them as exclusive to actually taking personal action. And maybe more importantly, I see them as complementary. So, you know, the question is, how does political action happen? And oftentimes it is an effort by a small group of people at the individual and community level, and ultimately at the political level, that moves the needle and makes things acceptable that once weren't in terms of regulation or mandates. And so I guess it's a both and sort of proposition more than either or. And again, it's not to take responsibility away from anyone, but I think it's important to say it's not just politics that matter.
Let's go to Vern in Eau Claire. Vern, hi.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So,
sure.
Like I say, aircraft are the number one transportation greenhouse gas emitter because the water cycle, you know, controls the Earth's temperature, basically. They contribute like 25%. But this cycle we're going through is not caused by mankind, and there's not much you can do about it. But you can, like I say, the aircraft, they fly 24/7. They're creating like a giant spider web of ice particles and water vapor in the atmosphere, upper atmosphere, along with CO2. And the only way to remove this CO2 is to go to what's called regenerative farming. But you can write to the White House, do everything you want to. It won't do any good.
Vern, thank you for calling in. Vern, wanting to talk about aircraft travel and the impact of planes.
Yeah, it's about 2% of emissions, definitely a significant global contributor. And we're going to need to come up with a new system besides burning fossil fuels to get there. And I think we already have some of the technology for short-haul flights to go electric. We're starting to see sustainable aviation fuel, which essentially is finding, in theory, carbon neutral or less low-carbon sources of fuel. But we definitely aren't there yet. That remains, I think, an unsolved problem. That's going to be much harder because you have to pack so much energy on a very small craft.
What do you think of those offsets where you buy your plane ticket and then you buy some type of carbon offset? Does that work?
Well, that's a very broad question. There are a lot of offsets that don't. Some of them are either outright fraudulent or just are not very effective. But I think some of them do. And the problem has been in the market is understanding which ones are which and then finding ones that are affordable that have 100% certainty. And I think as you ratchet up the certainty in terms of emission reductions, you have to pay a lot more. So that's the conundrum we're in. I wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater with them, but I would say it's difficult to pick the right one. So that's a future column topic.
The Washington Post's Michael Corin, climate coach, focusing on furthering the conversation on climate solutions. And you can talk with Michael at any point. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The climate coach at the Washington Post, Michael Corin, joins us to talk about the environment and potential climate solutions. A shout out to Louise in Milwaukee, Margot in Menominee, and Val in Eau Claire for suggesting we take on more climate and sustainability topics. You can join the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, we heard from Dennis in Pensacola, wants to know if there have been studies comparing EVs and vehicles that burn fossil fuels when taking into account the manufacturing of the vehicle and its components and the use and disposal of batteries used for both.
That's an excellent question. There have been, and I'm actually going to be writing some feature columns on that topic. We can get into a lot of detail, but suffice to say, when you look at the lifetime emissions from a vehicle, the construction of that vehicle is the small percentage of the total emissions. It's almost all after you get to, you know, 10, it's like 50 or 100,000 miles, is really about the fuel you're burning, because you're basically amortizing all of those initial emissions from construction or manufacturing into the total. So just to say that, when you're buying an electric vehicle, the initial energy that goes into mining some of those minerals is a little bit higher. But over time, and you're basically looking at a payback within a few years in terms of emissions, you're seeing a much lower emission profile from an electric vehicle, assuming you're charging on an average grid in the United States.
You have also fielded questions about whether electric cars might crash our electric grid. What would happen if everyone started driving electric cars?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we have, you know, case studies of this. In Norway, I think the percentage of cars, electric vehicles sold in terms of the total share of vehicles is around 80%, I believe. It's well over 50. And, you know, the whole stock hasn't turned over, so there's still quite a few fossil fuel vehicles, but they haven't seen many problems in terms of bringing those onto the grid. And that's not to say that if we switch tomorrow, that wouldn't be a problem, but at the rate of adoption that we're seeing, electric vehicles should provide an asset more than a liability, because they charge at off hours. Typically, you're charging at night or even during the day when there's high demand. My electric vehicle, for example, has a smart option that can charge based on when prices are lowest. And eventually you create a system where cars are essentially batteries that they can then supply energy back to the grid or to your house at peak hours, so they can shave those costs off or that load off. So in theory, we should actually treat them as a grid asset, not as a liability. But there has to be a lot of planning that goes into that.
When you talk about the mining and the transition to EVs and solar energy requiring lithium and cobalt and copper and nickel, and that can cause in itself environmental damage and human suffering, how can people mitigate these problems when adopting supposedly green technologies?
It's also a great question. And I think you're absolutely right. So mining in particular has massive impacts. Those are, I think, both on the environment, but particularly on societies and cultures near those mines. And that's been the history of mining since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And so I think that needs to be at the forefront of you know, our priorities when we're subsidizing and encouraging green technology. We also need to think about the impacts that fossil fuels have when we mine them, which at the moment is orders of magnitude larger than the clean energy economy. So I think something around 15 billion tons of fossil fuels are mined and extracted each year, which is about 500 times more than what we're extracting from the clean energy economy, or at least projected to do so. It may be less. I've seen numbers really kind of all over the map, but the reality is we're going to be mining a lot less minerals for the clean energy economy than the fossil fuel economy. So how do we prevent those impacts? I think that actually then does come down to both politics. So making sure that we have standards, which are starting to come into place for things like cobalt and other metals that are used in our vehicles and elsewhere, as well as our choice. You know, we have a choice of where to buy those cars and to checking whether manufacturers make commitments to doing that responsibly.
Colleen in Madison wants to turn our attention to plastics, called in to ask about the amount of plastics we're using made from petroleum and not being disposed of correctly. What are your insights there?
Another very charged question, and one I want to write some more columns on. But I've actually had to take a lot of time to really study this. Look, I think when it comes to glass and metal and paper, these are pretty robust recycling systems. There's a relatively, you know, a decent price for those materials, and there's quite an extensive system to recycle them. Plastics do not have that at the moment. We can do that, of course. There are some plastics that can be at least reused, if not always, you know, recycled and put back into the system. But I guess, you know, I'm not going to say definitively what the answer is here because I don't know, but there's something called extended product liability. And if you think about it, right now we are subsidizing companies for their packaging. So they create packaging that can never be reused or recycled or isn't. And we pay as ratepayers to put that into a landfill. We also pay as in terms of the environmental impact on our communities and world. So I think when you pass something like extended product liability, you begin to address that market failure. And I think we should demand that of companies, that we don't subsidize packaging for them, that they make that our goods with things that can be recycled or can be recovered in some way. And we certainly aren't there yet, but we're moving in that direction with other minerals and other materials.
The Washington Post climate coach Michael Corin with us as we look to how to live more sustainably in climate change and taking your questions and comments. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We got an email here, Mary, wanting to know if solar rebates for residential installation are going to become more available and affordable for homeowners in the near future. What is the outlook, Mary asks?
The outlook is very good at the moment. There is quite a bit of options available, basically for what's called electrification. So it's not just solar, but actually taking your home, taking individual fossil fuel powered appliances, as well as your electrical system, and then getting quite a bit back. And if you're middle to low income, these are unprecedented incentives. I think there's a good site that you can go called Rewiring America, and they will, you just plug in some of your zip code and some information, and it will tell you what's available. I will say it's a little difficult to claim some of these still, because the Inflation Reduction Act, which was just passed, they're still working out the details. But if you're looking at, let's say, an electrification project where it's solar and you're replacing maybe a gas furnace, there's thousands and sometimes tens of thousands of dollars on the table.
One of the concerns about solar farms is that they're taking over valuable farmland or undeveloped land. Is there a problem with where our country is building solar farms?
Another great question. They're absolutely correct. There is a lot of land that is needed for wind and solar. And so citing that is going to be one of the great challenges going forward. There's already 8,000 projects that are just waiting to be approved so they can plug in to the grid. And we don't have a streamlined solution for this yet. But it's not necessarily exclusive. So if you're using land for wind, it is not, you know, preventing the use for agriculture. And the same with solar, actually. So a growing number of projects are called agrivoltaics. And so essentially you're able to both grow food, particularly vegetables, and have solar on the same property. And given that you're seeing $500 to $1,000 an acre for some solar leases, it's a very competitive offer. And so going forward, we're going to need to do, I think, some of both, which is site solar panels on brownfields, rehabilitated mines, landfills, things like that. But we also need to find ways that we can sort of do both. And I think that's possible. We're going to need a lot of renewable electricity, and it can't all come from wind.
What about empty parking lots? Bloomberg's City Lab estimates about 2 billion parking spots are being used by about 200 million cars. Why are few solar arrays being built over parking lots to get dual use out of that land?
That's a fantastic suggestion, and I think it should be. And there are very small cases where it is. I don't think it's two challenges, let's say. One is cost. So it's always harder to build on places where you have to get permissions and permitting and talk to many different owners. And so there are some transaction costs there. So I think we really need to figure out, and this is not true in other countries, where the permitting process and streamlining that. And, you know, I think we're going to probably move in that direction, as you said. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of you know, prioritizing it and creating the national imperative behind it. But we just haven't done that yet. And I think once we do, and once it becomes plug and play, then we'll get there a lot faster. But it's going to take some time.
Matt in Madison emailed to say mass transit is the answer. Individuals using the amount of resources required for one electric car is unsustainable, and we need a public transportation option, a robust one. What do you make of Matt saying, look, we have to use public transit?
Yes. I mean, I'm a big fan. I ride it almost every day, and I ride my bike, and I have a car. I don't use that car very often, but you know, I think most Americans in this country do have a car. And unfortunately, the solution, Matt is correct, we should have cities that we don't need, or even communities where we don't need vehicles to get around. Hmm. And I think we don't have those right now. And we need to prioritize those to get to a place. I think that would actually make us all well off. I should say that a lot of these things that we talk about are sometimes framed as sacrifices, but they really aren't. They really do contribute to the quality of life in many ways. So at the moment, I guess I meet people where they are, which is they have a car or need a car to get around in some ways, and we need to transition to a place where that is not the only option that they have or the only thing they need for mobility. So again, It's a tough problem that's going to require a social, societal answer. But in the meantime, we do need to transfer a lot of these vehicles to electric propulsion or alternative fuels as we build communities that are better linked.
The Washington Post, Michael Corin writes the Climate Coach advice column, and its newsletter is tackling thorny questions about the climate crisis, offering solutions for sustainability along the way. Call in with a question for the Climate Coach, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What a pleasure to have the Washington Post climate coach, Michael Corin, whose work focuses on furthering climate solutions and sustainability in our everyday lives. You can discuss your climate question. The number is 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mike in Shell Lake. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What would you like to ask the climate coach?
Well, I'd like to ask a question and point a thing out. One, when are they going to get these cars to an affordable price that the common person can just can buy and own and be able to operate them? And when are they going to get it to where you get the same distance out of a charge that you do a full tank of gas?
Mike, thank you for those questions. First, the timeline, and then, you know, getting as much mileage as in a tank of gas, Michael.
Great questions. So let's see, the price. When Tesla first launched, their explicit model was to say, we're going to build a very expensive car, and then we're going to use that money to build a less expensive car, and then we're going to use that money to build a mass market vehicle. So we're probably on step two, realistically, of that plan, and that goes for other electric vehicle companies as well, even though Tesla would say that their Model 3 is mass market, and it is around the median price of a car today. But his point is valid, that we really haven't seen that happen at low prices, primarily because prices of cars generally have gotten so high, and people are willing to pay a premium for these electric vehicles. And so you've basically seen the automakers sell luxury and expensive models of their electrics rather than double down on these cheaper ones. One of the exceptions, which has been really interesting to watch, is the Chevy Bolt. Great vehicle. People love it. It had a slow start, and Chevy initially said it was going to discontinue, and then they recently came back and said, no, we're going to build as many as we can. We're selling them all. And those technically start around $26,000. And I think that's with incentives. And so we're really getting now into a point where these vehicles are just starting to hit the market that are below the median price of a vehicle. And that's actually up above $40,000 today. So he's absolutely right that most aren't. But I think in the next 2 to 3 years, you're going to see a lot more hit the market.
And as more hit the market, will mileage improve?
And you are seeing mileage improve. So, you know, I think that is going to be a process. We're going to see steady improvement in lithium ion, and that's getting us to 250 to 350 mileage per charge. And then we're starting to see new technologies. So the latest that I've seen is 600 or 700 miles for a charge, which would be more than any tank in an average vehicle. But at the same time, I want to emphasize that we don't necessarily need 700 miles in a vehicle, and that as charging infrastructure improves and it speeds up and we're seeing those start to emerge, we're not going to need these big batteries to drive around these cars. We can actually fill up very quickly at a very low cost, usually at home overnight. And so it'll be a tension, a trade-off between can we pack as much battery into the car as possible, to can we just have a smaller battery that we, you know, works very well and charges quickly.
Let's bring in Dave in Sheboygan. Dave, what's on your mind?
Hey, great show. Love the topic. I'm a lover of Mother Earth. She needs a break. So my comment is, even though I want to get into the electrified world sooner than later, there's too much range anxiety out there. And range anxiety, if you don't know, is you got this, you know, you paid $80,000 for your, you know, whatever, and it goes, it's got 500 miles per charge. Within a week, you will have range anxiety. So I don't want to live that way. I'm a hybrid guy, and I think the hybrids will get even more sophisticated, where the engine will happen less and less and less and less. And I think right now, if you keep your car under 40 miles an hour on some of these hybrids, the engine never turns over. You know, let's make that 60 miles an hour and the engine never turns over. But you've got it if you need it. Range anxiety. Bye-bye.
Dave, thank you for calling in. Michael, you know, bringing hybrids into this conversation.
Yeah, and I wrote that column recently about EV range, and a lot of people are about hybrids, and a lot of people love them. And I think if you live in a place where you don't have extensive electric charging infrastructure, they're a good option. And many people have found that they barely even use the engine, which is great. The long-term future, it's a little unclear to me. I think we're probably going to see a world in which having two propulsion systems, so gasoline and battery, isn't the most efficient. It does cut your range for battery and for gasoline, or just for your battery. Mm-hmm. It makes sense and will continue to make sense for a while, I think, for people who live in these areas. But once the infrastructure is there and the batteries have improved, it will probably economically no longer make sense. But in the meantime, they're a good option.
I want to land on the brutal heat waves and that are alarming people that climate change is happening now. And you say the world mm-hmm. needs a new way to talk about heat. What is problematic about the way people talk about extreme heat?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, humans are not really accustomed to some of the temperatures that we're seeing and projected to see over the next 100 years. And the reason is that temperature and humidity interact to become more dangerous than it might seem by the thermometer alone. So, for example, if you're at 100 degrees with high humidity, that's potentially lethal. And we're seeing those types of conditions more and more often as the planet warms and as more water enters the atmosphere, water vapor enters the atmosphere. And so when we talk about, there's lots of different ways to measure this, and I got into that in the column. The most straightforward is the heat index. That is going, sometimes it's called real field temperature. Basically, that's going to look at both the different conditions around you and say, what's the risk to your health? Heat is a leading killer around the world because it stresses your heart and your lungs and your cardiovascular system. And so if you're at risk or you have any risk factors, that can be quite dangerous. And then when it's very humid, then you have something called the wet bulb globe temperature. And that was originally designed for the military when they were doing drills and people were passing out or even dying on the field. And that tries to say, if things are very humid and very hot, where is it safe? And there's a lot of rules around that. So in the next couple of years, expect to see, I think, meteorologists and just even everyday people talk more and more about heat index and maybe even wet bulb globe temperature.
We have just a few seconds left, but in writing about climate change, has it made you more or less hopeful?
You know, humanity has always figured it out. We've always found ways to fix problems that we're dedicated to solving. I don't think we're going to emerge from the next century without serious damage and displacement for a lot of people. Mm. And we're already starting to see that, of course. But when you do look at the numbers, when you look at the technology available and what needs to be done, there are no shortage of plans. There are no shortage of feasible plans to get where we need to go. Mm. Whether we as a society and whether we as a world decide to do that
remains to be seen. Yes,
the cost is only a few percentage points of GDP. Then I think
Michael, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. Michael Corin writes the Climate Coach Advice column for the Washington Post. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The year is 1992. Bill Clinton is elected president. Tennis great Arthur Ashe is Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year, using his platform to advocate for HIV/AIDS awareness. And Madonna's Erotica music video premieres on MTV. We dig into the political and social context in which Erotica was released and how it informs cultural debates today. And you can be part of this conversation. Call in with the question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Dango is an assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College. His new book is called Madonna's Erotica. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning, Kate. It's great to be here.
Good morning. So Madonna's body of work, it is extensive. Why did you dive into the album Erotica? Why examine this one?
It sure is extensive. I've always been drawn to Erotica, even though it's kind of an underappreciated album of hers. It's her fifth album, you know, not as popular as like a Virgin or something like that. But I think that it really encapsulates for me a lot of the interesting things going on in the 90s, a lot of important cultural debates, cultural wars over conservatism, over the presence of gay artists in public life. So it's just a really interesting touchstone for thinking about a number of issues.
Do you have nostalgia for Madonna's music? What do you think of it?
I do have some nostalgia for her music. I think one of the reasons I'm actually drawn to erotica is that I identify with it as a sort of transitional moment in her career, in the same way that I've sometimes felt like a member of a transitional generation in the gay community. I'm too young to have really been a peer of Madonna in the 80s and 90s. I'm also too old to have grown up taking for granted some of the civil rights that have been achieved in the past decade, like gay marriage. And I felt that like Madonna similarly is between kind of generations at times in her music. And in erotica in particular, she's really interested in hearkening back to some of the oldies. She kind of embodies this Marlene Dietrich character. She does a cover of Fever. Her kind of play with time periods is something that I'm interested in too. She seems nostalgic for the past in the way that I might be nostalgic for some of her music in the 90s.
As you talk about time periods, you really caused me pause when you said that we should be skeptical about progress narratives, that society has made progress in areas like equality and human rights, that things are better today than they were 30 years ago. How should we take care in using those comparisons as we sweep across decades?
Yeah, I think for me, there's a real uncanny similarity between some of the political and cultural debates we're having today and the ones that were circling in the early 90s, including some of the renewed anxiety around teaching gay and lesbian issues in university classrooms, to questions about race and police brutality. There's a real similarity, I think, between 1992, when Erotica came out, and 2023, where we are today. And for me, what that tells us is that, we shouldn't always think that things get better over time, that there's always this progress, as you say, in terms of civil rights, that sometimes there's a bit of a more circular pattern to history. And when we find ourselves in a situation that reminds us of the past, then we should be looking to the past for lessons for the present as well, in terms of how to navigate these debates that we're having today.
We're talking about Madonna's album Erotica with Michael Dango, who is author and assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College. You can join in the conversation, call in with the question, share your perspectives at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, how did you start to realize some of the faults within Madonna's work? Because you definitely lay them out in your book. how did you come to see those?
Yeah, I think, I identify as a fan of Madonna, but a lot of fans of Madonna have not been super happy with some of the things that I say in the book. I think for me, what's important when we look at some of our cultural idols is to not have this kind of black and white view where they're either going to be perfect and get everything right, or they're terrible and need to be canceled. We should think about the kind of complexity of the people that we look up to and have influenced us. And for me, Madonna does a lot of things right and has been really important for boosting the visibility of the queer community and queer issues, including in the early 90s, HIV/AIDS and the stigma associated with that. At the same time, she, doesn't get everything right. And I think that it's not just cynical to say that she's often interested in making money. And so sometimes she courts scandal, and sometimes that's related to advocating for political issues, is that it brings her more publicity as well. And so there's kind of both sides going on here, and I think that we need to be able to sit with that and appreciate what she does well and maybe what things we can also critique about her.
I was trying to sit with how you call her both archaic and avant-garde. You also call her Madonnasaurus, a fossil. And I mean, in terms of her fashions and the political movements at the time, like, how does she walk the line? Can you give us an example?
Yeah, I think one of the things that happened, for instance, in the tour of Erotica, when she went to perform the album in a concert series she called the Girly Show, is that she has this moment kind of partway through where she raises her fist in the sign of Black power. Mm. But then the monologue she proceeds to give isn't about kind of racial inequality at all, but ends up being about the gay community and HIV AIDS. And I think that's an interesting moment because it was important certainly to call more attention to the epidemic and the ways that the government was neglecting care for people who had HIV AIDS. But it's a complicated moment because she's also appropriating this image from a different social movement around racial inequality. And so I think that's one of those moments where it's hard to kind of judge what she's doing there, where there's something that we might really value, but there's also something that we might be a little critical or suspicious of.
And at this time, Madonna is releasing Erotica. At the same time, her pornographic coffee table book called Sex is published. Do these two, you know, things, album and book, do they share any connections in their messages? Were they a package statement?
That is often how these works were presented to the public, and it's how they were talked about at the time. So in addition to the coffee table book, which is just called Sex and is, as you said, pornographic and has nudity of her and also her boyfriends and lots of other people at the time, she also stars in an erotic thriller called Body of Evidence with Willem Dafoe and Julianne Moore, kind of trying to, you know, ride the wave of Basic Instinct and works like that. So this was definitely presented as like a trilogy of sexiness in the late 92 and early 93. But in my book, what I'm actually interested in is how the album Erotica and the book Sex are actually quite different. And Madonna came to actually regret that she released them at the same time because Sex, the book, shaded how people read or listened to Erotica. And for me, Erotica as an album is actually much more sentimental than it is pornographic. It actually has moments that I think are decidedly unsexy. And I think that that was actually an intention on her part in appealing to a couple different audiences, including her core audience of gay people who were struggling in the midst of this sexually transmitted disease of HIV AIDS to have a more ambivalent relationship to sex and sexuality. So she's trying to pursue something in Erotica that kind of sounds sexy and pornographic, but at the end of the day, kind of is more like holding hands and just trying to find connection at a real time of devastation and mourning.
Michael Dango is author of Madonna's Erotica, assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College, examining the 1990s culture wars, appropriation, the through lines to today. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We turn back the clock to unpack Madonna's 1992 album Erotica, revisiting an earlier moment in queer culture and politics and how it can inform our cultural debates now. Michael Dango is author of Madonna's Erotica, assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College. And there's space to talk. Call in with a question. You can share what's on your mind. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, you write about how the AIDS epidemic affected Madonna's personal life. Can you take us there? What was happening?
Absolutely. Madonna had a lot of really important relationships in the gay community in the 80s and early 90s. Her high school dance teacher, who was really the one who introduced her to a lot of kind of the show biz and developed her passion for entertaining Christopher Flynn, had died by the time Erotica came out, as well as her roommate in New York. And both of those figures are mourned in Erotica. There are lyrics that are devoted to her, to them in her songs. So HIV/AIDS was really personal for her because of the friends that she was losing, the mentors that she was losing, in addition to just being aware of how it was devastating a larger community, the LGBTQ community, that was a real part of her audience at the time and into the present.
And you cite an essay by Black feminist writer Audre Lorde that draws a difference between feeling and sensation. And you reference the essay when writing about one of the last songs on the album. And let's listen to part of the song In This Life. So you write how this is an invitation to community, particularly in dealing with grief. How is it a calling to be part of the album's message?
I think that what's so interesting about those lyrics we just listened to is that they come in the form of a question addressed to a somebody listening to this album. Have you ever watched your best friend die? Have you ever watched a grown man cry? And so she's inviting us into this kind of support group, as you said, where we might be able to hold some of our grief together. She's processing her own grief, but understanding that in addition to a loss of an individual, there's a loss to a community that those individuals are a part of, especially the LGBT community. And that's one of the reasons why this album is so different, as we were talking about earlier, from something more pornographic, like her coffee table book, Sex, because it's processing some of the traumas that are attached to gay and lesbian identity. And that's something that especially comes through in this song.
The queer communities from which she draws inspiration, she holds space, as you mentioned, in the music for the AIDS epidemic. At the same time, though, she's also using the imagery and perhaps appropriating. What is going on there?
Yeah, it's really complicated. The kind of question of, is she giving back to the community as much as she's taking from it? And Erotica is interesting for that as an album because it's her first album since the release of her single Vogue, which probably remains one of her most popular songs. And Vogue is named after a genre of dance that was developed by especially Black and Latino performers in the Harlem underground ball scene in New York, a scene that she would not have been participating in because of her racial and class position. And so there's a lot of questions about what it means to take that name and that kind of dance and start to perform it at the MTV Music Video Awards, for instance, as she does. And when she does, she performs it, not as an homage to Harlem, but in this kind of French classical costume that she borrows from Dangerous Liaisons that was released at the same time. And so that's a moment where it seems like she's taking something without really drawing attention back to the community that produced it. And I think that there are lots of moments like that in Madonna's career and in anybody's career where some of your influences, some of the things that inspired you end up becoming your own and something that you're not sharing with the community that it comes from. So there's both going on here. And I'm not trying to claim that, you know, she's just a terrible appropriator or that she is this wonderful saint that gets everything right. She's a complicated figure in relationship to the queer community.
Let's listen to a bit of Vogue. So, Michael, bring us to now. How does Vogue exist within today's Drake Ball culture?
Absolutely. I mean, we've had a real explosion of increasingly mainstream attention, too, to voguing and to the ball culture and to drag. Ryan Murphy's show Pose on FX was about this scene. And of course, voguing continues to be, you know, constantly referenced and adapted in things like RuPaul's Drag Race. So that remains such an important part of queer culture. And a lot of people's introduction to it, I think, is through Madonna's Vogue. And I mean, for the record, Vogue is probably one of my favorite songs of Madonna. I think it's a great song. Folks who might not know some of the history behind it might think it's something that Madonna created, for instance, as opposed to the original performers in Harlem. So I'm glad that there's more representations these days that I think tell some of that longer history and allow us perhaps to connect a present scene of queer life to a past scene as well.
Michael Dango with us, author, assistant professor at Beloit College, as we look at Madonna's erotica album and a new book. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. So Erotica is Madonna's first album on her own label. How can you hear a shift in her music?
I think what's so interesting is how she is thinking about a kind of market strategy at the same time. So, you know, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, Erotica's released at the same time as this movie and this book. And so she's, you know, kind of trying to do a packaged marketing. At the same time, it's within some of the lyrics too, as I think you're alluding to, that she's really beginning to embrace her identity as a businesswoman, not just a performer. Just a year before Erotica comes out, she's on the cover of Forbes magazine with the headline, you know, America's smartest businesswoman, ? And I think the answer to that question was, yeah, probably. She has this multi-million dollar deal at this time. And so she uses a lot of references actually to sex work in her lyrics in Erotica to think about how her job as a businesswoman is itself a kind of hustling, a kind of trying to sell things, trying to get clients, trying to get satisfy people's desires. That's something that becomes increasingly a presence in this album, is this anxiety around money and how to make it.
Examining Madonna circa 1992, themes that resonate now, Michael Dango's new book, it's called Madonna's Erotica, researches feminist and queer theory as an assistant professor at Beloit College. Join the discussion, call in with a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore political and social touchstones of Madonna's Erotica album from 1992, its legacy in today's cultural debates. The album came out at the height of the AIDS epidemic. Michael Dango is author of Madonna's Erotica, an assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College. And you can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. As we examine her hustle ability, if you will, and not only to be an entertainer, but to be this build a business empire, what role do Madonna's movies like Body of Evidence play in the overall reception of this particular album, Erotica?
It's interesting because in Body of Evidence, she plays this kind of femme fatale character who is accused of killing a millionaire that she was sleeping with to get his money. And so there's a kind of performance of sex work there and of being somebody who's going to sell sex just for herself. And this is something that people were always talking about in relationship to Madonna because she was, compared to many of her peers, so sexual in her performances and in her lyrics, that she was somebody who was selling sex, that she was hustling in that way, too. One of the kind of earliest covers of her in Rolling Stone remarked that she seems to only turn on the sex act when the meter is running. So this kind of sense that it's not genuine, that she's just doing this to make a buck.
And you find Erotica one of her least sexy albums. And so, and that you write about, you know, people's simultaneous fear of sex during the AIDS epidemic and their desire for closeness. How does Madonna convey that concept through this album and through her music?
Yeah, I think in a couple ways. One of the ways is just in the sound of the album. There's a lot of really kind of atmospheric sounds, like kind of being immersed. It almost feels like being in a womb at times, being held by the music, something really comforting, as opposed to something that might be, for instance, arousing, something that's a little bit more like being hugged, as opposed to something explicitly sexual. Some of it also comes through in the lyrics. We listened a little bit ago to the lyrics mourning some of the people she had lost from AIDS. And so a tone that's much more of an elegy as opposed to, again, a kind of come on. And another thing that she does in this album, actually, when she does end up talking about sex, which again is not actually very common in the album, but when she does, it's often with a bit of a sense of humor. So for instance, in one of her songs, Where Life Begins, which is referring to her genitalia, she has a lyric that goes, Colonel Sanders said it best, finger licking good, referencing KFC at the same time that she's talking about a sexual act. Mm. And for me, you know, I don't think it's super sexy to think about fried chicken right when we're about to have sex. And I think that she's similarly trying to use humor to kind of defuse some of the tensions we might have around sex and sexuality at this time.
Let's listen to another song. This is Deeper and Deeper, and let's listen to part of the song. So you describe Deeper and Deeper as an example of cultural appropriation. Can you explain why?
I think Deeper and Deeper is appropriating a bit by way of Vogue, which is referenced in the lyrics, Let Your Body move to the music. She's also sampling a number of things in this song. The kind of style of the song is a bit all over the place. There's a flamenco bridge partway through because she had just been kind of in the Caribbean where some of that music was playing by way of Spain. There's just a lot of musical styles coming to bear on this song. It's also one of the reasons why the song, I think, is probably a bit too long for what it's supposed to be. It's like almost 6 minutes long because it's just so hungry, I think, for taking in so many kinds of musical samples.
I noticed that too, going back to the song. I was like, I don't remember it being this long. How a song today wouldn't be this long.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, is there a distinction, though, between cultural appropriation in more physical material means such as instrumentation and sampling and immaterial things like language and the words in the song and ideas?
Yeah, I think that's a good point that maybe sometimes some of the sentiments of a song are coming from a community as much as the style of it. I think we can also, you know, distinguish a bit between moments in this album that are like outright thefts and moments where it seems like Madonna is trying to participate in a larger community. So in the title track, Erotica, for instance, she actually just takes a sample of an Easter chant from a really famous Arab singer named Firouz, without, you know, any kind of consultation or anything. And to this day, Erotica is actually banned in Lebanon because people were so upset that they would steal from the singer that was so popular in Lebanon. So there are like these kind of moments of theft, which seem very clearly to be kind of moments of cultural appropriation. Whereas even in something like Deeper and Deeper, although it's weirdly eclectic in its music, the kind of ways that it's still speaking to some of the needs of the gay community at this time, again, that kind of sense of needing some human connection, even as there might be an anxiety around sex and sexuality itself, that's a kind of contribution that she's making. And so both things are going on here.
You also call James Brown the patron saint of the album the whole way through. What is the connection to his music and what Madonna creates here?
Yeah, I mean, James Brown is probably who sampled the most in Erotica. There's a sample of his 1969 Funky Drummer. There's a lot of the kind of woo and yeah from Lynn Collins' song Think About It, which was produced by James Brown. He kind of is contributing this sense of funk at times to the music, sometimes directly because of samples from his music and sometimes indirectly in samples of music he produced, since he was such a kind of prolific played so many roles in the entertainment industry. And I think that those kinds of debts are less acknowledged or explicit in Madonna's music. She doesn't call attention to them in the same ways that she might call attention to things that she's borrowing more directly from a queer community that she was performing in or on the same dance floors with. You know, she wouldn't have had that same subcultural belonging to the same spaces that James Brown was in. So he's definitely a great influence there, and she clearly is indebted to him, but maybe isn't acknowledging that debt as much as she does her others.
Michael Danko, author of the new book called Madonna's Erotica, as we explore the album, look at through lines, then and now, and the culture and politics of the time. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, fast forward some years. How do conflicts over creative control show up between Madonna and pop star Lady Gaga in recent years?
Yeah, there was actually a real big controversy a few years ago where Lady Gaga seemed to be borrowing from Madonna in the same way that Madonna had borrowed from others before her. But it was really presented as this kind of intergenerational conflict. Like Lady Gaga is the new Madonna in the 21st century. And Madonna obviously wasn't going to have that. And so she pushed back and made fun of Lady Gaga at one of her performances. But it kind of, you know, set up this bit of a rivalry between them. And I think that because both artists had such loyal fan bases in the queer community in particular, where, you know, Lady Gaga's song Born This Way, for instance, became a kind of anthem for a lot of the gay civil rights movement. There was a lot of friends I know who had to like take sides in that battle. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think I'm one of these people that like, you know, wants us all to get along and hold hands. And I think that there's much to admire in both of their musical careers.
Ah, hold hands, something how you describe erotica.
Absolutely. You know, it's something that we all want, right? Especially, I think, in the isolation that we've experienced during the pandemic. That was one of the reasons why I was drawn back to erotica in its reference to a different pandemic, is that I think just some of the feelings of being disconnected, of not being able to be with our friends, even after the height of COVID-19, there's still like, I think, a kind of latent social distancing that we never quite have recovered from. And that's something that Madonna's speaking to preemptively a bit in this album.
This is Assistant Professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College, Michael Dango's new book. It's called Madonna's Erotica, as we explore this 1992 album and the themes that resonate now. Where were you? Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Rewind to 1992. Madonna drops her fifth album, Erotica, and the entertainer and music industry powerhouse holds space for AIDS activism in her music, as we've been talking about. Beloit College Assistant Professor Michael Dango's new book, it's called Madonna's Erotica, offers cultural context then and now. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts to bring up 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We're just sampling a little bit of Fever there. What can you tell us about that song?
Yeah, it's such an interesting choice for this album. So, you know, covering maybe not even quite as well as Peggy Lee did in 1958. I mean, it was originally a song by R&B artist Little Willie John. I think what's so fascinating about Fever is that it takes on a kind of darker meaning in the context of HIV/AIDS, where the lines, you know, you give me fever, start to sound more like a symptom of a sexually transmitted disease. And so I think it's a curious choice for this album. It also just marks, though, I think, Madonna's larger interest in thinking back. This is, you know, a very nostalgic song, a previous musical era. It comes through, too, in some of the kind of smoky lounge vibes with the snap fingers and things like that. So she's still maybe nostalgic also for a period before HIV/AIDS, where fever wasn't such a triggering word.
Hmm. You think that the legacy of her music is mostly what we do with it. And I'm wondering, what should we do with it now?
That's a good question. I think that it's interesting what we make a Madonna a soundtrack for. And this is something that I've noticed ever since writing this book. You know, wherever I go, it's hard to actually go more than a day or so without Madonna playing in the background somewhere, you know, on the radio at the mall. You know,
I've had an earworm all week because of you.
Absolutely. And so it's kind of actually become a bit of a soundtrack just for day-to-day consumerism, for lack of a better word. It's because she's somebody that kind of everybody knows a bit, is kind of ubiquitous, which also speaks interestingly to how maybe she's become less controversial over the years, that she's maybe a safer choice these days compared to some other artists. But what I think, you know, remains most important is using her music as a way to honor and acknowledge the communities that she's borrowing from. So to go back to Vogue and some of the queer communities of color that have been really important for innovating music. That's important. We had a kind of revisit of this conversation when Beyoncé's Renaissance album came out, and it's borrowing a lot of the same materials that Madonna's drawing from in the early 90s, to the point that she collaborated with Madonna on what was called the Queen's Remix of her title track. And so that was a real moment where there was actually more mainstream attention called to the important original creators of voguing, for instance. And that's what seems most important to do with some of this music, is to allow it to be a way to honor the past, as well as sustaining queer communities into the present.
As I was navigating through the book and listening to the music, but really watching these music videos in a whole new way, and seeing your insights there. And I just, particularly in the song Rain and in the music video showing the Japanese technology and people working to make Madonna good, I'm just wondering, what were some of your takeaways from what were the messages, the visual messages of songs like Rain?
Yeah, it's such an interesting moment in how Asia and Asian aesthetics are being received in the West at this time, as a kind of sign of two almost kind of contradictory things. On the one hand, like really sleek technology and robotics, the future. And on the other hand, minimalism, a kind of, you know, Zen aesthetic, or Marie Kondo's, you know, more recently Spark Joy kind of movement that's become associated with Japanese culture. And she is drawing upon those aesthetics in a music video like Rain to similarly position herself as being both of the future and also in a way kind of the past. But it's complicated because of how the Japanese actors in that video, for instance, end up being there to literally make her look good. They're kind of cast there to like shine the lights on her and to be adjusting the visuals. So she's, again, having a moment where she's drawing from a particular culture, but perhaps not paying it back in the same way.
We're taking a dive into Madonna's works from early 1990s. Michael Dango, author and assistant professor at Beloit College, our guide. Still time to talk. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. As you mentioned, it's hard to go without, you know, a day hearing Madonna as part of some type of soundscape. Has Madonna influenced the direction of your scholarly research and where it goes from here?
It has, I think, particularly in my teaching. So I teach American culture a lot, and kind of surveys of thinking about American culture and politics from the last 100 years. And as I've taught those surveys, I've been struck by how, first of all, important Madonna has actually been for, again, this moment in the early 90s, as crystallizing controversies around censorship and culture wars related to that. At the same time, you know, one of the interesting things about being a professor is that I get a year older every year, but my students stay the same. And I think that for this generation, you know, Madonna is not as much of a touchstone, or, you know, she's this old lady. She did indeed turn 65. And it's been important for me to help my students understand the importance of figures that might even seem outdated to them today because of the legacy they've had. I mean, we wouldn't have people like, frankly, you know, Ariana Grande or Katy Perry or Lady Gaga, we talked about earlier, without some of Madonna's work paving the way to show that you could be a female entertainer and bring in the big bucks. So I think that that's something that continues to be relevant for me, is thinking about the kind of intergenerational scholarship we can do and how much we can continue to learn today from what might seem an older moment in pop culture.
Let's bring in Mike and Madison quickly. Mike, hi, go ahead.
Yeah, what was or what is her sexuality exactly?
That's complicated. Yeah, I think that especially in the early 90s, she really projected a kind of image of pansexuality. But she pretty much exclusively dated men. And in fact, biographers of her who have interviewed some of the bisexual or lesbian women in her orbit, those interview subjects tend to talk about feeling a bit used or led on even by Madonna at this time, of maybe being called in to make her look interesting or scandalous by having a non-normative sexuality, but not really in the end being interested in those relationships. So I think that her record indicates that she's frankly pretty straight, but has nonetheless been really important for the queer community.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been lovely having this conversation and listening to some Madonna together.
Michael Dango, author of Madonna's Erotica and an assistant professor of English and Media Studies at Beloit College. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.